All right, welcome back to Nashville Talks with Taylor Jones and company and friends and whoever else is here in the building. And dog, Chester's here. So we've been off for the summer, and that's been a good thing for me. I hope y'all don't mind. But, you know, the summer this year has been about work and just, man, keeping my nose to the grindstone, trying to pay those things that come in the mail called bills. And the podcast, you know, as much fun as it is for me, like, I do have to typically take a half a day or so off from my regular jobs to make it happen. And, man, to be honest with you, like, I couldn't afford to do that for a while. So that's why we took the summer off. And also, too, like, you know, it's weird how the Lord does, but, like, I just, all the guests kind of dried up, too. So, but now I was like, man, I was like, Lord, if you want the podcast to go, you'll bring the guests to me and you'll make it happen. And so that's what happened here today. We'll get into what we're going to do today here in a minute. But Ian Stewart,
hey,
the producer, is back in the building.
I'm back.
Man, you've been through a summer of your own self, haven't you?
I have.
You got you a new job.
Big job change from an Apple type job to selling home loans.
Selling home loans?
Yep.
So you're selling people their mortgage. Is that what you're doing?
Exactly.
Well, how do you like it?
I like it better now than I did 2 months ago when I first started.
Oh, yeah?
End of the day, I love working with people. Yeah. And once I got comfortable enough with what I was doing there, because I've never been in this industry. Mm-hmm. So once I learned a little bit more about the industry and could really just focus on the people, that it makes all the difference.
Well, and like you said, I mean, you can adapt to anything.
Mm-hmm.
And shoot, you don't come out of Glencliff High School without learning how to adapt to anything.
Right.
That is for sure. Google it, people, if you want to know what I'm talking about. Google it. You'll see what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so I'll give you a little update what I've been doing. I just got back from summer camp, which is why if you've been following my Instagram, why I have a Hulk Hogan mustache, because they wanted to do mustaches this year for camp for all the leaders. And when they first asked me about it, I was like, no, I ain't doing that. But then I got to thinking, I was like, well, I ain't going to be the only one that didn't do it. Like, are you serious? Like, that's worse than anything. So it gave me a reason to cut that old big beard off. It was hot. Summer was coming. And so I cut that thing off and worked me down a big time mustache. And
mm-hmm.
I kind of like it, to be honest with you. It's been better than I thought it would.
I do, too. It's taken a while to get used to, though.
Yeah. Yeah, it's different. But you know, the jury's still out on what Kyla thinks about it. So
no, that's the most important
opinion. I think she wants me to even back out again. So, anyway, I'm working on that. We did camp up there in there's a couple churches in Smyrna, Delaware, and Middletown, Delaware, that I have some great friends that are at, that work in leadership up there, and they're a couple church plants, and they're both growing really well. That's a different kind of country up there. Like, you know, it's not as churchy of a place as down here in Tennessee, where, like, honestly, we need another church plant. Like, we need, you know, another cotton field, I guess, in the South. We just got so many churches everywhere. But that's not to say that there's not a reason to still do it, but you get what I mean. In Delaware, man, like, you know, what I found out about up there is, like, there's a lot of, you know, people that maybe come from, like, a Catholic background, per se. And that's, like, the only church background that they may have. So the idea of, like, going to a church that's not a denominational church at all, but just a church that's preaching the Bible. And there's a lot of newness up there, is what I'm trying to say. So I remember we did this worship night last year after camp on a Saturday, and it was like, man, it had to be 90 degrees in the building, too, because the air conditioner didn't really kick on. I haven't been that hot in a while. Like, it was so hot that, like, you know, halfway through, you're kind of wondering if you're not going to need a pickle bucket or something nearby to have to hurl in or whatever. But we got through it, and it surprised me. Like, they just promoted it as a night to come worship Jesus, not as, like, a picnic or whatever, but, like, they just promoted it for what it was. And the building was, I mean, it's a good size. It was a junior high school auditorium. It was packed, man. And so it was like, wow, people in the community just want to, like, come see what's going on over in here. Like, they can feel something buzzing. And whatever, 5 or 6 years of that church has been planted now.
Mm-hmm.
It's grown pretty cool. And my good friends, Cage and Kelsey, or Cage is a worship pastor at the second one at this church plant called in Smyrna, Delaware. And so We did. The youth group kids up there are, okay, let me put it this way. If you followed any of my stuff on the thing, like, all these kids are in shape and can dance and are tan. I don't get it.
In Delaware.
Yeah, like, we were all, like, frumpy, little skinny, you know, pasty, white, you know, uncoordinated kids when we were growing up.
No kidding.
But these kids are all, like, dude, like, that, like, is what they do. And it's all a reflection on leadership, like, the youth pastor and his wife are some of the coolest people ever. And, like, so you do camp in, like, the morning. There'd be, like, camp songs in the morning, a little quick Bible lesson, and you go off into guy-girl time. So it's, like, all the guys go with the guy leaders, all the girls stay with the girl leaders and mm-hmm. do that. And then you go and you have, like, the middle fat part of the day to just go whatever. It was on this really cool campsite in Amish country up there in Pennsylvania. They have pool and your gym and what do you call that, zip line. Ooh. and the obstacle course thing where I look up there and I'm like, no, y'all crazy, I ain't getting up there. And the kids get up, they can do all that and whatever and have a good time, and then you have lunch and dinner, and by the time you get around to after dinner time, that's when like you have the actual worship time where we were, you know, I was in the worship band, that's what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'd have 4, 5, 6 songs ready for that, and then we had a guest speaker who was awesome. Jamie Caldwell, he killed it. Man, they preach right down the middle up there, too. Like, they don't, man, honestly, like, they're preaching, like, dude, you need Jesus to be saved. Like, that's what they preach. Like, straight, it ain't no filler, man. It's great. So, and a lot of the kids, man, they're not necessarily Christians, too. Like, they're coming to summer camp. But it's about 120 kids, I think, something along those lines. You get through with the worship set, you know, and everything, and the speaker, and then we play out or whatever. And they worship. Those kids, they know the songs. They want to sing to the Lord. Like, it's something, man. So they go off, and then they have something called late night. Okay, and so after they go back up there, get a shower, get dressed, whatever, and every night has a theme. Like, one night was 80s night. So you had
awesome
all the 80s clothes. Another night was prom, Goodwill prom night. So you had... that Goodwill prom, and so they did that, but what they do then, by then it's just like a DJ party,
right?
And so the youth pastor's wife was like the DJ, and she kills it, bro. Like, she plays all the good stuff, and the kids know every word to everything, and they know all the dances, and I'm just sitting there like, dang, man, like, this is crazy. Like, this is a really cool group, and they all love each other, man. It was just a really cool thing. So I did. I go up there about twice a year for the winter retreat and the summer retreat. And it's always something to look forward to. So Lifehouse Church in Middletown, Delaware, and Smyrna, Delaware. If you're up in that area, that's a good church. So that's what I've been doing, really. And other than that, trying to kick out of whatever this funk is I've had the last couple of days. And my throat's kind of sore, so if I sound kind of different, that's what it is. You know, there ain't none of that Sammy Sosa stuff going on over here. Nothing. Don't worry about that. But... but anyway, so bless him. So we're gonna let's just get right to it. So this is, I want to introduce my two guests today. Me and Ian, you already know who we are, but
mm-hmm.
I had this idea about a year ago, and to be honest, like, this may be the most different podcast we've ever done or whatever, and it's not really music based or anything this time, but it was an idea that I had because, man, there was a lot of stuff going on last summer, and with Jamaica, just violence on the street and people getting killed on the street. Specifically, there was black people getting killed on the street. And I'm thinking, like, and the conversation was so polarized. Like, it was just, you had, you know, one narrative over here, which is more like the white narrative, and then you have the black narrative over here. And I just felt so much separatism going on, and the fact that we just weren't understanding each other. I mean, I was having conversations with family members where, like, you know, even just saying, like, hey, don't you think it's a little screwed up that this has been 3 or 4 times now on video and whatever, and there's no accountability? And like, dude, I don't know why, but they would turn against me. It's just like, I don't even know if it was actually because they felt a certain kind of way, or if it's just because they were naturally programmed to think a certain way and go with their own narrative as opposed to, I just thought, man, what if we could do something where we had an African-American person, a man and a Caucasian woman talking about some of these crazy issues? 'Cause, like, I was trying to get the most different angles that I could get Okay. Because to be honest, like, I know for a fact that I'm going to learn something today because I have the perspective of a white guy. You know what I mean? I don't, there's no possible way I can know what Keith is going to say here in a minute and what Christy's going to say in a minute. And it excites me because I want what I'm not, we're not claiming to be experts. I'm not an expert. Like, we just had a little time of prayer, and it's like, we just want to be stewards of what we have. And what we do have is a healthy community, you know, of friends here that we all, you know, have went to church together over the years and done some, we you know, ate a lot of meals and been to Israel together. Christy's coming back on the show. I forgot we already did one, right? So that's what this is about. This is about real friends, church family, people that are watching a crazy world, and how are we going to love each other through it? How are we going to teach our kids to love each other through it and other kids through it? Even though, man, like, the real narrative that we're getting is pretty, like, I just feel like it's trying to separate us more than ever. So without further ado, I want to introduce my two guests. We're making our return, Miss Christy McClellan.
Morning, Taylor.
From Cleveland, Mississippi. Is
that
right?
I'd like to say congratulations on the mustache.
Okay.
I'm for it.
Okay.
We'll see what Kyla says, but
hey,
K-Mac's for it.
Okay. That's what we're talking
about.
You
say Mississippi?
Mississippi, yeah. You know about what part of Mississippi you're folks from?
Picayune.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Lord.
Been there several times.
I'm actually going to Poplarville this next weekend.
Yes, you are.
Yep, going to go down and see my whole dad's side of the family, but my mom's side of the family lives in Columbia.
Absolutely.
Wow.
I have family in Columbia.
Really?
Way down south. Yeah,
yeah.
Hattiesburg.
Uh-huh, yep.
Yes, absolutely.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I grew up in the Delta area.
Okay.
Little town called Cleveland, rural
yes.
Mississippi.
Uh-huh.
Cotton and catfish, Taylor.
Yeah.
Cotton and catfish down there.
Cotton.
Mosquitoes everywhere. 100% humidity.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a lot.
That's one of the big, one of the meat-eating mosquitoes.
I think I spent some time with a church down in Cleveland.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh.
Remember which one?
It's been many years, but I
grew
think,
up at Calvary Baptist Church there.
Wow.
That's where I accepted the Lord. It's
wow.
where I was baptized.
Oh, that sounds familiar.
It's a great
it was
church.
with my old youth group. We went down and spent time with a church down there and went on a canoe trip, kind of camped out on the riverbank and got up the next morning, canoed some more. Yeah, that sounds really
sounds
familiar.
Sounds like Mississippi, man.
Man, I'm just going to say this. Are y'all familiar with Last Chance U on Netflix?
I've heard of it, not
okay,
seen anything.
Okay, it's about East Mississippi Community College in Scuba, Mississippi. I ain't never heard of no place called Scuba,
me
Mississippi.
Neither.
And they got a football team down there, and it's a JUCO. So what happens is somebody gets in trouble at, like, Tennessee or Florida State or Penn State.
Mm-hmm.
Like, let's say they either with their grades or they get caught, you know, this and that, get kicked off the team. Well, you have to do a year in JUCO to kind of get back into good graces of Division I again. So they'll have, like, these bomb players come down, and, man, they just run the table on the whole JUCO. And they've been, like, three or four times national champions in JUCO or whatever. And the kids only come there for a year, and then they roll out, and they get another shot, so if they do right. And but, yeah, I was thinking about you because Scuba, Mississippi.
That's right.
Ain't never. And, man, the way that they talk, I could almost, like, I couldn't hardly understand them. As Southern as I am, some of the people there, I'm like, dude, what? I just couldn't hardly, but it's worth a look if you want to see some Mississippi nostalgia.
Okay.
Mercy. It's like a real life Friday Night Lights, except college version, and man, there's some drama, and that old coach, Mercy. I kind of have mixed feelings about him. Sometimes I think he's all right, and other times I think he's too much. But, man, he don't care who you are. He will holler at you.
I'd actually like to meet the man that you feel like is too much.
No,
Taylor.
Man. You meet him. Google Buddy Stevens. Buddy Stevens. Woo, Lord. And to my right here, Brother Keith Grigsby. Where are you from again, Keith?
Born and raised Franklin, Tennessee.
Oh, my goodness. So
one of the six people that's still there.
That born and raised
native,
there?
Yes.
See, because, like, me and Ian are born and raised in Nashville, and we feel like
right.
we're the only ones. Everybody else we know is moved here from someplace. Yeah. So, Keith, you are a master chef on the grill.
Yes, he is.
Follow him at K Grigsby on Instagram. He's the grill master. Well, do you grill every day?
This summer, not. Last summer, every single day.
Yeah.
This summer's been a busy summer, so I haven't really got on the grill.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to kind of space it out because getting where I work at, getting the building ready for the kids to start back in August. So hadn't had the time.
I got you.
Been good though.
But you need to follow him. Look up Keith Grigsby on Instagram. Just every week he'll have something beautiful coming off the grill.
Absolutely.
Whether it be a fat 2-inch steak of some kind or a whole fish.
My goodness.
Or asparagus and all that stuff, corn coming off the grill. His kids are going to be, I don't know what they're going to do when they leave. They're not going to be able to find food.
They're going
to
starve.
Yeah, they're not going to be able to. Hey, when it comes down to, you know, cooking ramen and rolling to McDonald's on a McDonald's gift card. Hey,
I didn't even know they had McDonald's gift
cards. My dad one time as a rib got us a McDonald's gift card. Like $100 worth of McDonald's.
That's hilarious.
Because for Christmas. And so he's like, y'all go to McDonald's all the time. So he's like, here, this is $100 at McDonald's. And so I was like, okay.
You used it too, didn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, back then I could eat that stuff more often. Now, man, no. If I eat that, it takes me 2 days to get over it. You know, and you got to be careful what you eat the older you get, man. You can't just be eating like you used to. Like one time, I can't do Taco Bell in the middle of the day.
You can't do Taco Bell anytime, huh?
Bro, I can't do Taco Bell in the middle. There ain't no way. But I told somebody this. It's like in the middle of the day, I'm like, man, anything but Taco Bell. But if it's about 1 or 2 in the morning, hey, let's go to Taco Bell.
Yeah.
I don't know why it's that way. Because you know it's there and you know it's open. And they got caramel empanadas. Those things are good. If you're not smart to the caramel apple empanada, man, you need to go bless yourself and just go get her a dollar, man. They're a dollar, bro. Them things are good. Those are good. So that's all I'm going to say about that. Callie and Phoebe smarted me up to those years ago, and I never heard of it. I didn't know Taco Bell had dessert. I mean, yeah. If you see Taco Bell, you don't think about dessert. But also the cheesy gordita crunch. That's doable. Okay? I learned about that this week at camp because there wasn't nothing up there in Amish country but the Taco Bell. And now coming down the hill, I promise you, I saw more horse and buggies. I saw a horse and buggy coming through the Walgreens drive-through pharmacy.
Oh, no.
I said, y'all really doing that? I said, that's some kind of a conflict right there. Y'all got a horse and buggy, but you're going through the drive-through at the Walgreens. So... anyway, that's kind of what's been going on. These two right here, okay, the reason why I called them specifically is because, one, I know they're not afraid to talk about it, okay? Because, you know, you have to have a certain rapport with one another to, you know, for this to actually work and not to feel like you need to kind of hide what you actually feel. And, you know, I've had conversations here or there with both of y'all about this stuff on different occasions, but the idea was to get y'all in the same place. And, you know, I got a little list of topics or whatever, and I want to throw some softballs at you and just kind of hear both of y'all's perspective. So there's really no easy way to ease into it. So it's kind of like jumping in the cold tub. Just jump in it. You know what I mean? After 3 or 4 minutes, it'll start feeling like regular water. So that's kind of what we're going to do. So, Keith, you grew up in the South, sir, and how old are you, if you don't mind my asking?
I am. I forget sometimes because I'm getting that age now. Okay. So you kind of drop off numbers every once in a while, but around 46.
Okay, somewhere in and around one of those 46.
Yes.
So I just want to ask you, this is just a general question, but what was it like for you growing up in the South, not to mention in a Civil War city as Franklin, Tennessee? The Battle of Franklin, Google it, people, if you haven't ever heard of it. Pretty big battle in the Civil War. And, man, there's a lot of, you know, Southern pride down there, like old school Southern pride, like rebel flag Southern pride. What was your upbringing like in Franklin, Tennessee in the last 46 years?
In the last 46 years, so from begin to now.
Just some whatever big memories stick out or whatever from like grade school. And I guess the specific question is, have you ever experienced racism in the South?
Yes, but my upbringing, let's put it this way. I was raised in the projects.
Where are you? See, I'm already learning. I didn't even know this.
Projects, a mom, single mom with 4 boys. And a mom that was a mom, you know, she was there, she was present, she was on it, she did her thing in the projects. Well, never, we lived in the project, but it was a diverse, we grew up with white, Hispanic, it was everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So we never felt like we was ever separated, never thought about it. Now, you had houses around you that was people that had more money, but you never, it really never sat in your conscience about it, because we all play it, no big deal. Walk to school, close enough to walk to school, and... then it was a subtle, it's always been the Battle of Franklin, it's always been Confederacy, but didn't think about it. Never hardly saw it. Now it's a different story.
Ah.
It's a different story. Then it was always there. You, it was present. You knew it was. But everybody did their thing. You do your thing. Now it is in your face. It has switched. It has changed. It's like more open. This is who we are. We love the Confederate. The Confederate flags fly everywhere. And everybody's okay with it. When I was growing up, it wasn't like that. All these places didn't have the Confederate flags hanging outside the buildings. Even though they was like battlefields, didn't happen. And now over time, as people, gentrification happened, people was getting pushed out. The black people was getting pushed out. And people from the north, the east coast, west coast, they don't think nothing else about it. It's no big deal to them. So now it's okay to start displaying this because you're not going to get pushback on it because nobody's around. So now you got them buying up blocks of where black people lived and worked and went to the store, tearing down all these buildings and just make a battlefield park. And just flame, and then wave the Confederate flag.
See, that surprised me because you just said that you feel like now it's more prevalent than it was back then. Where my initial thought would have been, well, of course it was more back then.
Absolutely not.
See, that
it's more. You feel that you feel like it feels like you're unwanted now versus when I grew up.
Wow.
Well, you know, even. I kind of feel the same way from when we were kids. Like, I don't know if it's just because we were kids and we were a little bit sheltered from it, but I felt like growing up, race wasn't a thing. You know, you just never really heard about racism. But I also think back in the 90s, you know, there was a very big, like, worldwide cultural push to just kind of make everybody, like, we're all equal, no matter where you're from, who you are, like, we're all equal. I felt like that was a big PBS kind of thing.
Well, too, Keith mentioned growing up in a diverse community, and that's the same that, like, you grew up in a diverse community as well. So did I. You know, like, we went to the most diverse high school in Nashville.
No kidding.
Like, no doubt about it. Go Google it, like we said.
I think officially white was the minority at our high school.
50-something language represented over there. So all that to say, like, I definitely agree that now that we mention it, like, it does seem like more of a mainstream issue now, like we've taken steps in reverse, like went back 100 years or something, and that is just not what I would have ever predicted.
Yes,
like I never would have predicted. So now, on that note, Christy, growing up in Mississippi, what in the same frame there, what did you kind of see growing up out down there?
It's interesting listening to you guys because I did not grow up in a diverse city. I did not grow up in a diverse neighborhood. The church that I attended was not diverse.
Well, there's hardly anybody there.
Right. The school that I attended was not diverse. But, you know, Mississippi, when I was born in 1974. I'm 43. But you could feel the fact that things weren't always as they seem. You know, there was definitely language of other. We don't go to church with them, speaking of African-Americans. Or I honestly don't remember that many Hispanics even living in Cleveland when I was growing up. So it was very much a homogenous genesis for me, a homogenous sort of upbringing. And it was when I accepted Christ at 9 and really started reading the Bible, I came across that passage in Galatians about now in Christ, there's neither slave nor free, male nor female. We're all one in Christ. And I just knew that somehow that preaching of God through the scriptures was not the world that I was living in, that something else was going on. So I always tell people, as a white person, not even female yet, but as a white person, one of the most striking things about the issue of race in America is it's so easy for majority culture to just never look at it, never have to look at it. I feel like for white people who are rooted in the kingdom and rooted in the gospel and seeking to live among a diverse community and see the kingdom of God come in a way that brings reconciliation and unification and healing, there's an intentionality that we experience waking up every day and agreeing to see it. Just agreeing to see it, to ask about it, to listen, to know that it's true, to not look away. because it's so easy for majority culture, I think, in any culture, when that's the narrative that's predominantly put out there. As a member of majority culture, you really do have a choice every day. And I love meeting white people who, my friend Kim Washington in Dallas would say, who are woke. They are woke to the issues. They are awakened to some of the realities. And man, it's so funny. You don't ever have to ask an African American, a Hispanic, anybody in a minority in America if there's racism. You don't even have to ask them. But when you talk to white people, you get a variance of responses to that. So I'm just grateful for the community that I get to live among. I think it's so important for white people when it comes to race relations to listen. I think that we need to really listen some more after that, ask questions. And if what we're hearing goes against our experience of life and our white skin, to listen and to know that it is very real. That just because it isn't something that we have ever experienced, we don't get to sit back and say, man, I've never had that experience. That can't possibly be real. But to say, my goodness, I've never had that experience, but that's absolutely real. And I want to live in community with you in a meaningful way. So tell and teach me the world through your eyes and through your experience. And what does it look like for us to lean into this together?
Amen. So, Keith, where'd you go to high school at? Did you go to Franklin High School?
Or? Franklin High, which mascot is a rebel soldier.
Which is why I wanted to ask that question. Because we were at, okay, Christy, you have this great backyard area, and we go over there from time to time. And it just, honestly, it's church community, even though everybody's scattered about everywhere, but it's still like, you know, meeting place. And a place to break some bread and, you know, see how people are doing and go around people that actually, man, like, that do care about you. And one of the days we were out there, one of our brothers, somebody asked if you were elected mayor or governor of Franklin or Tennessee or whatever, what would be one of the top three things that you would do? Now, I was tuned in because... one, I've never thought about that before, and they weren't talking to me, but they were asking him. And one of the first three things he said he would do is he would change the name of Franklin High School Rebels and change it to something else. And that's not to disrespect, you know, I don't want anybody to get their feathers ruffled here as far as like, oh, well, tradition, and, you know, and we'll get into that in a minute. But, you know, as a white person, like, you know, our definition of tradition, you know, means one thing to us. But, you know, it can mean something else to other people. So, but when I heard him say that, I couldn't believe that that was so high on his priority list. But then again, I was thinking, well, yeah, he drives by that place every day, probably. He's got to think about sending his kids to school there and whatever, and more generations, the more, you know. And then, but how did that, tell me, how was that for you, and what do you think about it now?
Then you didn't, you knew it. You accepted it because that was the only high school I can go to. What were you going to do?
You're the one you, like, mm-hmm. You had a choice.
And have a choice. Didn't like it, but you had to go. But now what they've done, and it's still technically their mascot, but all you see is the big elf now with the circle. They've migrated away from the still rebels, and that's still their mascot, but they've trying to replace it subtly, and which is odd because Franklin is going in the opposite direction about showcasing what they said their heritage, you know, but Franklin High is not.
So did they used to have like a little man on a horse, Confederate guy or something?
Oh, it was a little man standing there. He wasn't on a horse. He was holding a gun with the little hat on.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And he's still around. You'll see him around.
He still makes an appearance.
He's around, yeah.
Now, was there ever a rebel flag involved with that?
No, not then. That's okay. Probably now would be if, but then it was subtle.
Yeah,
it was there, but it was subtle. It was so subtle that being teenagers and kids, your last thing on your mind was going to be you just having fun.
Yeah, yeah.
But that it was still prevalent. It was just kind of we're in control. It was still there. Mm-hmm. But now it's like I said, it's just open now. It's just like in your face. Deal with it.
Aye. So going back to Mississippi now, there's a little university down there called Ole Miss University, and they're called the Ole Miss Rebels. So I feel like a couple years ago, I don't remember exactly, but they had a rebel flag featured in some part of their entrance on the field or whatever it is. I needed to do a little more research on that, but it just popped in my head. But isn't that interesting how a couple states away you have this similar vibe going on down there? But how did that, I mean, I imagine, did you even pay attention to that, or did that even cross your mind?
Not when I was living there, mm-hmm. you know, and I mean, I was so young. I think now it's just, if we back it way up, not specific to any particular issue, in every culture, symbols mean something. Mm-hmm. They are often rooted. They are communicative. They are telling us something. They are conveying something. And oftentimes when we're speaking in terms of flags, names of places, there's a sense of your flag is like your banner. Mm-hmm. It's a symbol of something that you are for. And so I just think sometimes there's a reason, I think, as human beings, we have feelings built around these issues, because symbols have always mattered. Whether it was the Egyptians, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Israelites, the Greeks, the Persians, the Romans, all the way to today, symbol matters. And so I think it's a really good thing for us to continue to talk about, because I hear a lot of people speaking, well, it's tradition. It might be tradition that you have that symbol, but that symbol represents something. And it's often something rooted in history and in ideology. There's a history behind it and an ideology that it represents. And I think that's where we have feelings about it, when we see a certain flag or a certain symbol, a certain sign. I always feel something deep in my soul when I see pictures from the civil rights era of the white-only water fountains or the black-only water fountains, and I wasn't even alive for that, but every time I see an image like that, I feel it. I feel that. Those symbols, those images, those pictures, they matter. They're not just tradition. They're telling us a history and an ideology that was at play during that time.
Mm. So I'll just confess something. So growing up, like, you know, the rebel flag or whatever, it was not really on our radar. Like, I really didn't learn about that till later.
Honestly, you know? My biggest experience with the rebel flag growing up was Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Exactly. And when That's I saw that, it. You know, we, this is how I thought about it. When we were young, which isn't 10, you're talking 10 or 12 years ago, like, I saw Lynyrd Skynyrd. I thought, oh, that's cool. That's kind of their shtick. That's kind of their deal. And they openly, you know, if you go listen to interviews with Ronnie Van Zant, like, the record company was the one who branded them that way. He said, we never, you know, he said we never flew rebel flags at our shows, you know, before we were, you know, signed or whatever. He said MCA wanted that. They wanted to brand it that way because they knew there was a certain audience that would latch onto it. So I understood that, but like for me, man, the idea of like, dude, when you're going through your rebellious stage and there's a thing called a rebel flag, like in my mind, that was a cool thing because I was rebellious.
Right.
And just as a teenager, and I was so ignorant to the situation that I had no idea that, honestly, that, you know, that anybody had any feelings towards that. If you did, you kind of, whatever, you know, but it took like a few years to actually, I mean, literally a lot, like coming to know Jesus, to understand, like, dude, like it's one thing, like whatever, you know, not being ruled by your feelings, you know, and say, dude, it's one thing to feel like, okay, you're a proud Southerner or something, you know what I mean? And here's a flag for yours. And even if you think that what the, you know, historically what they did was noble and fighting for their cause and all that, which, you know, that's a whole another ball of worms right there too, because I hear that argument a lot, you know what I mean, around here. But like, if this hurts like my brothers, you know what I mean, which I have three, you know, biracial brothers, like, come on, like, this is ridiculous. It doesn't matter if I like this thing. Like, this thing is at best misunderstood in a lot of horrible ways. So you just kind of got to like lay that down and be done with it. And, you know, because it's one thing to have an hour to explain why you feel about you feel something, but it's another thing for somebody to take a glance. And the truth is, like, if I give that person the opportunity to take a glance and say, whoop, look at him, that's my fault. You know, that's on me. And I just, man, I repent of that. I'm sorry for that. You know?
Yeah, you know, as I'm thinking, there was a lot of people that served in the Nazi army and thought they were doing noble things.
Right.
They fought for their country based on what they knew. But you don't. But here, it's not a pride thing there. It's history. It's something we remember, but it's not a pride thing that my granddaddy or my great granddaddy served in the Nazi army. You know, it was. But here, for as a rebel or Confederacy, it's like a pride thing.
Mm-hmm.
They've latched on it and made this thing not a remembrance thing. It's not a history thing or a heritage thing. It's become a pride thing. That's the problem. They're taking pride in this symbol, what it represents, and what it to this other community, and they're okay with that. That's a problem. And you don't see that globally in other areas. Now, you can always have people say Nazi flag, whatever. But globally, as a group of people, you don't have that. Look around the world. You don't see that.
Mm-hmm.
But here, and it's okay. It's on all my shelves. And you go,
wow, you're right.
You go, you can buy license plates and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that.
It's okay.
Yeah, it's very much, man, like, sometimes I think for the sake of selling stuff and making money, like, we will stoop to some lows.
Yes.
And because it sells, like, bro, like, go to Gatlinburg. Go to yes. Gatlinburg and look how many rebel flags are out there. Yeah. And you wonder why white kids around the world don't think it's a big deal.
Right.
I mean, that's a shoot. Like, it just, that's how it was for me, man.
Walking distance from my house, walk across the street, which is not Natchez, which is a predominantly black neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Was. It's changing. The Carter House, which is,
yeah,
always had the rebel flag waving, which I understand because it's like a museum.
Yeah, yeah.
But now, you walk them down that street, the whole block has become a Confederate park.
Really?
I mean, literally, within the closest neighborhoods to there is black communities.
Mm.
And surrounding them is all these parks that's Confederate parks now that wow. didn't used to be. They used to be houses that they tore down, stores, Pizza Huts, that they tore down to make the predominantly black people, kids used to go to and eat, they made a Confederate park out of.
Wow.
And they're okay with that. That's an issue. That's a problem.
Wow. See, I would have never known that.
I've watched a whole neighborhood just literally change and become a park that had buildings, not just it was already fields, so they can make parks and tell about the history of the Confederacy and wave their flag.
Man, I just, one of my friends posted a thing the other day about, where Central Park is. I don't know if y'all ever heard of this, but that was from 18 something or whatever. Like, that was one of the first parts of Manhattan that was like an African American community. Mm-hmm. And they tore it down to make Central Park.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not saying they're putting rebel flags up in Central Park, but it's just like, why here?
Yeah. Because a park is the easiest thing to accept from everybody. You can get rid of something, but if you put a park, everybody can come. It's easier. Other than getting rid of to put another big building. So it's easier to accept because it's a park.
Yeah.
You know.
So it's like feeding them, chocolate pudding as opposed to turnip greens. Yeah.
Now, how many times will I walk in that park?
Uh-uh.
How many times I'm going to walk and see the statues? And how many times? Not me. Not my kids.
No. Well, man, that's...
And I don't mind. I love history.
Yeah.
I love engaging in history, understanding history.
Mm-hmm.
But this is when you bring history and you trying to live it now, that's the issue, especially when there's a history like that. We can go to museums and look at history all day long. Mm-hmm. The internet is, you can pull your phone out.
Yeah, yeah.
It don't have to be in your face.
And you got to look at it every day.
Every day.
And you didn't have no choice.
Didn't have no choice.
Right. Christy, did you know that was there like that?
I mean, the gentrification that's happening in Franklin right now.
Yeah. See, because Christy lives in Franklin as well, in case we didn't clear that up already. So, man,
And I want to make it be clear. I love Franklin.
Yeah.
I'm still there.
Right.
So I'm not taking a hammer and just banging the head over. I know I love Franklin. I think it's a great community, a great place for my kids to grow up. But that's truth. That's facts.
Yeah, that's
there. What's going on, yes.
See, and I would have never, ever, ever known... Like, going back to being a white guy, okay, in his 20s. If I drive through there, how else would I ever known what that used to be?
You wouldn't know.
I wouldn't know, because one, I didn't live there, and two, nobody told me.
Right.
But now, like, just even knowing that, oh, man, it's almost like a joke or something.
And
like
one of the biggest, when it first began, it was the Optimist Center. It was a big gym.
Mm-hmm.
All the neighborhood African-American kids, black kids, you know, I prefer black, but we differ on that. People do. But that's where they hung out at. The ones that didn't have everything couldn't go where. This was the place you go play basketball all day, all night long. Yeah. You could stay off the streets. This was it. And it's a park now.
Yep.
I mean, people literally grew up from kids to grown-ups and being protected in this building from the streets. And now it's a park.
Now it's just grass. Confederate
Park.
Oh, my goodness.
So is that not a smack in your face?
Well, it definitely
to the black community?
It definitely goes to show you that there was not a black champion in power that was able to have a say-so in it.
That's correct.
Right.
Franklin always had, you had pastors from different churches. They pastor people, but it was just on that very small level. But who pushed the, I hate to say black agenda or equal agenda, that we're all the same, and frankly, nobody.
Mm. Well, I tell you, man. Oh, man, I really don't know where to go off of that, man. That's heavy. I didn't even know that stuff. So, I guess one of the reasons why, you know, I called this together or whatever, I called you guys like a year ago, and we were all in different places a year ago. Everybody was moving around, you know, transitioning jobs and this and that. And so I'm glad it's, you know, now that we're all kind of settled in and locked in what we're doing, we can actually have these conversations. But, man, I was seeing a lot of police, I'm just going to call it police, you know, brutality, you know, towards men and women, you know, and there's a pattern here, okay? And the pattern is that all, like, the victims were black, and it was on video. And the other part of the pattern was that everybody was getting away with it. Nobody was being held accountable. And buddy, look, like, my next door neighbor growing up, my grandma's house, is a police officer. And she's been a great person in my life. I'm not burying the police. You know what I mean? I've got a friend, another friend that I love dearly, that's a former police officer, you know, and that's not the point here. I'm not trying to wave some kind of blanket, but everything's a case-by-case basis, right? Especially in a court of law, right? Everybody comes in and here's the case, and what's we gonna do about it? And for, like, I don't know, that whole summer, it was just, are you serious? They did it again, right. And the poor man in the car, I just, and forgive me for forgetting names, but the poor man in the car, that his girlfriend and the child was in the car, and I'm thinking, there's no way they're getting away with this, you know? But I guess the question is, Keith, is, man, how do you view that situation? How does that make you feel, man?
First, like, I know a lot of police, a lot of great people. So what we've done in society is when you speak against something, then you speak against the totality of that thing. Like, you speak against police brutality, you're speaking against the police, and that's not true.
No.
They condemn you that, oh, you're a police hater, you're against the police. So people are scared to speak out on that act or the truth because it makes them, they're convinced that if I do that, then all of a sudden I'm going to get branded, I hate the police. And that's what society has brought us now with the social media. That's not true. So when I say this, I'm not against the police. I love the police. I think we need police.
We'd be lost without them.
They do their job very well, but that doesn't change reality. The reality is, let's put it this way. Out of all the brutality cases, murders, or whatever you want to call them over the last year, all these officers that went to court, every one of them got off.
Mm-hmm.
Now, look at the percentage of that. 100% has gotten off.
Yeah.
If you just look at the percentage in logic, there's no way. There's always different perspectives. You always don't know the whole story. It is no way it'll be 100%.
Mm-hmm.
That's a problem.
Yeah.
Just look at that alone. What in life do you notice 100%?
Nope. I mean, I guess that when I see this happen and I go, and Christian, get your view on this, but, like, I almost feel like it's a predetermined thought. Like, the court is not going to prosecute their own.
No.
And when I see that, I go, holy cow, man.
So when you got an individual that knows that.
Oh, yeah.
You got an individual that don't have to think through a process. What's the best way to engage this?
Mm.
I'm just going to be the controller. Control the situation, and you're going to do what I'm going to say, or I'm going to handle it like I feel like it. there is no thought process. It don't have to be, because nothing's going to happen to me.
There's no incentive to not kill you.
Yep.
Basically.
And it makes it easy for done. We'll move on.
And we'll come back to, I have another question specifically about how you feel when you are approached by a police officer. And we'll get to that in a minute. But Christy, when you saw all that stuff going on, and I'll say this, like, just to paint the picture of who Christy is and why I feel like her opinion is, you know, matters on this, is you worked in leadership at a place that was a diverse church for 17 years and walked on, you know, really intimate levels with, and not only just on staff or whatever, but with women, African-American women, and it's not lost on you, in other words, some of these cultural issues. But like, when you see all this going on, what comes to your mind?
I mean, it's heartbreaking. Before my mind, it's heartbreaking. And back to listening, I've been able to process so many of those stories in the media with my friends. And again, I will probably reiterate this so many times sitting here as a white female, but it is listening to my African-American friends tell me how they are processing those situations and understanding that lens and hearing their perspective and knowing that there's truth in it. You know, we are a people as human beings. Bias sits in all of us. I don't believe there is a human being on the planet without bias. And so there's so many different filters and different lenses to see these stories. I will say that I am grateful. I think that part of what has come with technology is these stories are now told. They are being captured on people's iPhones, police cameras. You know, there's all the issues out there about policemen wearing the body cams and different things. And we are now able to see what minority culture has been telling us for years and years is going on. But again, it was so easy to just say, well, I don't see that. I've never experienced that. And again, just because you haven't experienced it as a white person doesn't mean that it's not happening. I guarantee you my experience when I get pulled over by a policeman is incredibly different than Keith's, both how I feel in that moment versus how he feels. We were joking driving over here. My license tag is crooked on my car. Has been, I think, since the day I bought it, probably a year. And we were joking about how, you know, a blonde female, I'm driving all over Franklin. I haven't been pulled over yet. Mm-hmm. But if Keith pulled out of his driveway, you know, with a crooked license tag, he would probably get pulled over. So there are different experiences. And again, I just think it's really important to listen. It's disconcerting to watch some of those videos. And I think it calls for a response from us. I think it's nearly impossible to look at those things and to say nothing, to feel nothing, and not to seek in some way to lean in.
So it's funny you mentioned, as you're speaking there and talking about, like, I get in the vision of, I watched Callie and Phoebe get off with police officers every time.
Yeah, no kidding.
I mean, dude, they'd get pulled over for like ridiculous things, like expired tags, no blinker light, and driving too fast. And it's like, oh, sweetie, just, you know, get that fixed or whatever. And like, they didn't even worry about it. Whereas, like, and I imagine, like you said, like, you know, young blonde female, no problem, buddy, not gonna be a problem. So I want to get back to Keith. Like, when you see, because my heart skips a beat when the blue lights hit me. I don't think that it's the same as if when it happens to you. So what's that process like for you?
I can remember the process is the same in every vehicle that I drive. The blue lights come on, regardless of what I'm getting pulled over for. All my windows go down and every light in my car is on before they get to me. My hands is on the steering wheel. That's what I was taught. That was what I was raised. Don't give anybody any reason to do anything to you.
Mm-hmm.
That's instilled. That's what I've taught my son.
Mm-hmm.
That when the police walk up to my car, he can see everything inside of my car before he gets there.
Mm-hmm.
There would never be a mistake. That's fear.
Right.
You don't learn that kind of stuff unless it's fear.
Right.
But I've watched white people get pulled over. You just let down the window. Hey, you know,
how's it
talking,
going, brother?
How's it going? Everything. Hands all over the place, you know. Not me. No. Mm-mm. And I used to have a, you know, I drive now. I drive a big truck now.
Yeah, yeah.
With something traditional, you wouldn't think of a African-American right. black guy would drive.
Right.
It's got tinted windows. I used to drive a car that had tinted windows that probably was on the car for 15 years. Mm-hmm. That would be something that, in, if you want to stereotype people, that, you know, it might be an African-American driving
right,
this car.
Right.
Literally, all the time, get pulled over for my tint. Nothing's wrong with it. It's illegal. That was the reason. Literally, all the time. Turn a corner, lights come on. Turn a corner, lights come on. It was ridiculous. Not speeding. I've been pulled over one time in this car. Most time I ride with my windows up with the, in the truck. One particular morning, I did not have my windows up. They were all down. So you can see who was actually in it. The only time that I've done that, I got pulled over.
Dang.
Didn't get a ticket. Didn't get anything. See, it was just, I forgot what the reasoning was, but the same thing, windows down, hands on the steering wheel, lights on.
Mm.
So, wow. there is an issue with it. That's a, without a doubt.
Wow, man. See, and like, man, I've gotten pulled over 100 times, and man, I've even gotten smart with the police sometimes, you know, because like, it's like, oh, I know somebody. I'm going to call this in.
Never happened with me, ever.
And like, stupid now. This is like before, but still, like, I've literally like, where I called my person and was like, hey, can you get me off of this? She's like, nope. He said you got smart with him. Like, I'm lucky he didn't jerk me out the car.
Yep.
And like, I remember hearing a story about, you know, it was like three black dudes in the car with the white driver, and the white driver gets pulled over, and he's cutting a interview on the cop, and all the guys in the car are scared to death. And I was like, really?
Oh, yeah.
And for me, it's literally hard to believe.
And what's going on now, you got a lot of kids now, teenage black kids that's growing up, that a lot of them miss that fear. So they do kind of joust back with the officer or set something, say something, where when I grew up, I was specifically taught those things. A lot of those kids nowadays, so they think, hey, no, I didn't do anything. I didn't do anything. So what's happening now, the situation is getting intense. And you got to understand, the police officer is always the one in the control position.
Yeah.
Always.
Yeah, they got the authority.
They got the authority. And they got the law behind them in their mind. And normally that's the case because the law still protects them.
So how did you teach your son to deal with it?
Conversations.
Mm.
And you don't go start out, you know, in the car, you don't do this. It's just conversations about race, period. I mean, I've had conversations about, because I have never taught that you got to be with a black girl, you got to do this. You just love everybody. I mean, people are people. But I did have a conversation. That's a white girl. And if you go talk to her, you stand on her porch.
Mm.
You don't go in the house.
Wow.
Be visible. I mean, we've had those conversations.
Wow. Man, I had a teacher one time, you know, like I said, Greg Glencliffe, you know, and this is like 2005-ish, somewhere in there. And she was probably late 30s, you know, but she had like four or five kids, you know, and some of them were getting to be teenagers and stuff. And her son, well, I guess, was the oldest one. And she told us a story. I don't even remember how. And this would happen quite a bit at Glencliffe. Like, you'd be supposed to be in there learning chemistry, but it would turn into, like, you know, life stuff.
Mm.
And she was talking to all the black males in the room. And she said, listen, and she told the story about her son, you know, getting in trouble and whatever. And she's like, look, you got to straighten up, and here's why. And she said, you got three things working against you in life from the day you're born, brother. And here's what they are: young black male. And I was sitting there and I was like, whoa. You know, like, I guess that was the seeds being planted for like what was to come later. And but that always stuck with me, because like, nobody has ever set me down and told me like, look, you got a couple of strikes against you, just not even your fault. Like, never. You know, my background is, like I said, I got three biracial brothers, and you know, I grew up in a home where my dad, like, you know, one of his friends and one of his employees still works for him today, you know, Eric, his mother passed away suddenly, you know, and Eric was probably like 30 at the time, 31, something like that. And Eric had never really had his own apartment or whatever. Like, he stayed out there in, you know, North Nashville with his mother, and he'd come and go, and you know, he always had a room there, in other words. Well, once she died, everything went sideways, and, you know, so he would talk to my dad about it. And he goes, well, Eric, here's the deal. My folks just got divorced at the time, and my dad's a self-employed businessman, whatever. He has to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning to be at work and open and everything, get stuff to going, cooking white beans and whatever. Like, white beans take forever, so you have to cook them at 6 o'clock in the morning. Right. So the problem was, it was hard for him to do that and juggle getting the kids up in the morning, getting ready to go to school. He said, Eric, well, here's the deal. You can flop here for a while till you get on your feet, whatever. But as long as you help me out getting these kids up in the morning. And Eric worked at another restaurant for his full-time job at the time. He worked for my dad a little bit in between. And sometimes Eric would be out all night. But he would show up at whatever, 7 o'clock in the morning when he was supposed to. And he would wake us up. And he was like a brother to us, man. Like, the reason I watch wrestling right now is because of Eric. My dad didn't watch that. I never would have crossed my mind. But I used to sit there and watch with Eric. And him flopping there for a little while until he got on his feet turned into 5 years, which in that time turned into a lot of meals. You know what I'm saying? Because dad, like, when we went out to eat or whatever, you know, Eric was obviously with us. You know, we went on vacation. Eric went with us. You know, it was like, so in my mind, like, I did not get it. Even growing up with him or whatever, I did not get, like, what she said with young black male and everything like that. And but now that we've gotten a little older, like, I do kind of, I see it now a little bit, and I'm sad to say, but I mean, and getting into, like, I have written on my notes here, like, denial, and this is, like, I don't want to throw the whole blanket on this either, you know, Christy, I'm gonna come at you now, but, like, a couple months ago, man, me and my buddy, his window got busted out, and this is right out, I guess last summer when this out was all going on, and the cop was there, and he's great, you know, whatever, it was great help, and he was an older guy. He's probably 50s, white male, you know, southerner, you know, been on police force 30 years, whatever, nice enough guy. And I didn't even bring it up, but he said, man, I tell you what, I'm just about ready to retire. And I said, really, why? He said, man, I'm just tired of being hated. I said, you tired of being hated? I said, what makes you feel like you're being hated? He goes, well, just look around, you know, the police are vilified now and all this and that. He said, I'll tell you something too. He said, all those shootings were good shootings. And I'm taken aback by that. I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, really? Like, you actually think? And he was like, oh, yeah. And he gives me these examples about how somebody can have a hand in a pocket and they can shoot you through their pants pocket. And if they have, you know, little things like that. Like, the training, which brought me to, like, okay, well, there's clearly a training issue here. If, like, we're trained to think that somebody, you know, not to say that they couldn't, but it sounds like more the exception than the rule. But I couldn't believe the denial. In other words, and that's when I knew the denial was real, that it wasn't just in ignorant people, but it was in some of the people that are out here doing a job, you know, and that was what was really scary to me. So, Christy, what do you think? I just wrote down white denial, because there is a lot of denial that there is a problem, especially this particular problem. But like you said earlier, like, you can ask any black person in America, do you think there's a race problem? It's going to be, yep. You ask a white person, most of them are going to say no.
Yeah, there's a phrase, it's called white fragility, and it's real. I'll sit here in my skin and say it's definitely real. Not even specifically speaking to denial about the shootings and the police force, but if you back it way up, something that I've been noticing over the last few years, I have so many friends, and stay with me, it's going to take me 45 seconds to say this. I have so many friends, close friends, who've adopted.
Oh, yeah.
And when you're bringing in children through adoption, there's a lot of compassion, awareness, and a readiness to learn about early childhood trauma, issues of connection, lack of connection, different things like that. There's this sense of this child is going to have a unique journey in their unique story. So how can we learn about what they need? How do we put things in place to help them heal and succeed in school and relationships moving forward? And culture is completely fine to sort of acknowledge that and to lean into it. What's striking to me is this seemingly pervasive, your word is denial, but to look at the systemic effects of the transatlantic slave trade, 400 years of slavery and what that has produced generationally from trauma, trauma responses, everything that we know that we so often apply to adoption. When you look at the Holocaust of the Jewish people, there's a ready-made awareness, a compassion and empathy that it changed a people. But you know we haven't healed. And here comes the denial that anytime we bring up anything seemingly as a culture, and I'm using broad strokes here, and I understand that. Mm-hmm. So my language is superlative, and I understand that. Anything that takes its root in the transatlantic slave trade and colonial slavery and chattel slavery here in North America, there's a resistance to it. There's a resistance to look at it. It's very easily dismissed. It's very easily put away. Well, that wasn't me. That was an era ago. And language to disconnect us. And the transatlantic slave trade is not just Africa's story. It is Europe's story. It is the America's story. The transatlantic slave trade is our story. Mm. And here we are in 2017 trying to steward our shared story. And so it's just striking to me how in other areas and veins of thought, there is this immediate recognition, awareness, and acknowledgement. But when it comes to issues of race and different things like that, there's almost a ready-made lack of acknowledgement, which is what you're calling denial. Yeah. That is very interesting to me. It's like this one thing we can't even really look at in the face because of what it'll mean, what it would mean for us as a nation if we meaningfully, in a unified fashion, looked at it.
Keith, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'm going to go back to when you brought up the police issues, the reason I get specific about cases is because I didn't want to say that was wrong. I didn't want to do that because I wasn't there. So that's why I said it can't be 100% that they're correct every time. And that's true, but if you come to the officer you talk to for 30 years, he's ready to retire because he's saying it's 100% right. And there's no way. They're not even willing to say, well, maybe some of these cases could have went the other way.
Exactly.
So that's what I look at the bigger picture. There's no way 100%. In 30 years, he's going to ready to retire because he's been hated. Let's come to the black experience. Mm. How many hundreds of years we've been hated? But we're not okay to feel that way. We can't feel this way. We can't go retire from black.
No.
We can't do it. So, but he can go home and retire and live in his comfortable world, all white if he wants to. My skin is black. It's not going anywhere. Mm. This nation still says that majority is Christians. I mean, they all identify with Christians. You take a large percentage still say that. And if you take somebody who's a non-Christian, the first thing they say, well, how can you prove God exists? But in the Christian experience, I know that I know he exists. That's the experience. Why in the black experience, this is how I feel. How come we're so ready to deny that to the black people? This is why I feel this way, because of this. Why is the whole nation saying, you can't feel that way? Your walk here in the Christian walk, yes, you can. You don't have anything tangible to touch. It's nothing tangible to touch, but it's true. This is how I feel. Mm-hmm. But it's not okay. It's not justifiable because we can't see it. It's not real, you know. But it is. But if they're not there, they don't experience, then it's not real.
Mm. Wow, man. And I can feel the passion in your voice in saying that. And, you know, and I guess I've had to be careful to not be an apologist. I don't know if you've run into this walking closely with a few of your friends, especially from, you know, church days and I've had a couple of them just tell me like, well, I don't want you to be sorry. You know, that ain't what I need from you, you know? And I guess my problem is I don't really know what they need from me. You know, have you ever run into that?
Well, I think that we should ask what they need in friendship. Just to quickly answer that, it's back to listening. Again, you're going to hear me say it all day. I think that for too long we have assumed our perspective is the right one and the only one. For too long we've assumed sort of our way is right. And so I think when we as white people come to a diverse table, The way that we meaningfully engage first and foremost is through listening and asking great questions. And again, when we start hearing things that's completely antithetical to our experience, refusing to dismiss it because it's not our experience. Being able to expand our own sense of horizon and scale, that when Keith tells me stories, I never sit there thinking, is Keith telling me the truth? Mm. I know Keith is telling me the truth. And it's an opportunity for me in those moments to take his story in, that it becomes my reality. So if something is disturbing to Keith through his eyes, it's going to be disturbing to me because we're friends.
Aye.
And that's part of the journey. It's something that maybe immediately to my eye or through my lens would not throw me. But then when I talk to Keith and he's thrown, well, now I'm thrown. Because I love Keith.
Exactly.
And that's the power of a diverse table that we're all being invited to live and to move and sort of have our being together. I mean, it's the root word of compassion. In Latin, com is with, passion, pathos. To be compassionate is to be with someone in their pathos.
Wow.
And for us to enter in, to be a compassionate people, it's for us to listen and to enter in with compassion and passion, and together to seek just a shared awareness of a shared history and a shared moving forward in some of these things and some of these issues.
Well, I guess, Keith, let me ask you then, what do you need from me in that situation?
I think, because I would say that I'm probably built different than most people, so I would look at a broader, I think, just understanding. But in that understanding that you can't fix it for me, you understand that it is real. That's the number, that it this black experience is real. Really understand it, and then allow me to sit in whatever that means. You know, don't try to fix it for me, because too many times other people want to fix it. You can't fix what you don't understand.
Nope.
You can go build up a whole community, but that doesn't change who they are. You can build brand new houses. It doesn't fix what you don't understand. So throwing money at something never fixes it. You got to be compassionate. You got to understand that this is, first of all, you got to believe that it's real and let them know, let us know that we know this has happened. This is real. This experience is real. How many times do you hear that anywhere in the media, that the black experience is real? They'll talk about the black experience through the black eyes, but how many times you see other white people sit there and say it is real? I mean, in the media you might hear and there, but not as a coalition, not as a movement. Understanding, recognizing that it is real, and just truly be there and make friendships, and then watch where it goes. It'll take care of itself. But you got to get to that plan. You got to understand, recognize, and yes, we know, and let us know that we understand that it's real. I don't have the same emotional ties to it because you're upset, I'm upset. You know, and that's the problem. They want to fix it or it doesn't happen. Either they're going to try to fix it or it never happened. That's not an issue. There's no middle ground for most. That's not a problem. They just think it's a problem. Get over it. Or we're going to get all these communities in. We're going to throw money at it. We're going to throw money, but you're not actually helping the problem.
Sounds to me like time needs to be involved. Yeah.
A lot of time.
It just takes time. It's not something you're going to get to in a week.
Yeah, trust has to be cultivated in the round. I mean, with everyone at the table. But once it's there, you know, I feel so blessed. We are all a part of a community that we can say anything to each other.
Yeah. Well,
we can ask any question because we trust each other. Even if the question comes out sideways or crass or abrupt or something, we know the heart behind it. And so interacting becomes so much easier when that trust is laid.
And that's the key, because we trust. But you don't get the trust by meeting somebody one time. You got to go sit down with them and sit in it and be quiet sometime. Because just being there sometimes, people will start to trust you. You ain't got to say a lot. Just being there and want to listen to them and be a part of them. Don't try to dominate the conversation. Don't try to control it. Just be a part of it. Let it just sit in it. Go visit houses and just sit in it. You don't have to control it. So that's when trust is gained. When you don't try to control, when you're just there, And that's all. And you're happy to be there and learn and experience. Then you will start gaining that trust where you can say anything and nobody's going to get upset or they'll discuss it because we know your heart is in and we trust each other. And we're not willing to do that as a society is to sit down and be quiet and just sit in it. We all want to come from perspective. Just be quiet. Start to trust each other. Hang out with families. Put yourself in situations where you don't have to discuss black and white. Just with families and kids. Start to trust each other.
Yeah.
They don't have to be an agenda to get together.
Right. Right. And it's a patient game. Yep. It's a patient process. It's not something that, you know, oh, man, I'm going to make sure this is going to be on my list this year, things to do. Yep. You know, is I'm going to make sure I, you know, befriend some black folks. I mean, that sounds like a movie of some kind or some crazy, yep. You know, but.
But church, I've heard church pastors say, be intentional about shaking hands and go meet a black. But see, that's not what it's about. I can go shake hands with a white person all day long. No, go live life with the other person. Walk in their walk. Walk with them every day. Give them a call or a text. It's a continuous. It never stops. Right. Trust is not gang just going out to lunch on Sundays every month or something. Yeah, it's not going to happen.
Mm-mm. Well, and, you know, we were going through all that and I don't remember who it was. I want to say it was Ebony or somebody, but, you know, I was looking because, like, Kyla and Ebony became real close working together, and because they shared, like, an office that was smaller than this, you know, this little 20 by 20 room we got here, I mean, that thing was probably half the size of this, and their desks were like this, like, together, and Kyla's from Dagum, you know, middle of nowhere, small town as well, and, like, there was no black folks where she is from. And, you know, she met me, and it was like, okay, you know, we're in Nashville, and the place I went to church was very much, you know, focused on diversity. And she was like, well, you know. And I'm not saying she was against it, but she was just in shock, you know. But next thing I know, like, she's working there. And it's like, wow, what a turn, you know. And in the process, she ended up being partnered up with African-American woman who was also like a mentor type. You know, a little bit older, you know, further on down the line, kids and everything, home, all that, you know. And it became a beautiful thing, but it took some time. At first, it was like, oh, yeah, I like this lady. She's awesome. But it wasn't like, oh, this is going to be my best friend. She didn't know. She really didn't. And, but through that, now it's like, okay, you're babysitting the kids and you're coming over for supper. And it's, you know, and I want to think, I want to say her and Brian finally said, it's like, you know, making those situations on the regular as far as like just them happening like they would with your regular, you know, I call it your white community. Like you wouldn't think twice to go over to your next door neighbor's house and have supper if they were white, you know, and not saying that you would if they were black, but there might be that half second hesitation. You know, I don't know how they cook. Little things like that.
Right.
You know, like random little stupid things, but through all the, and I learned, man, through that, I was like, okay, if everybody's just pointing at the problem and we don't just want to do that, we're here to talk about a little bit of the solution. It's like, what can I do? Man, break some bread. Dude, just break some bread. Go walk at the park. Like, spend just regular things.
Live life with each other.
Yeah, if somebody needs some help moving, you want to bond, you want to figure out who your real friends are, send out a mass text and say you're moving next weekend and I'm going to need some help. And you're going to have about four good friends if you're lucky. If you got four of them, you know what I'm saying? Like that right there. But those bonding experiences like you have are what I think is part of fixing it. You know, and I feel like I'm the least qualified person here to talk on it. But I, you know, appreciate what I've learned from y'all and others in our community. And that's kind of where I'm living on it. Are we close? Is that close to accurate?
I just live life with each other.
Yeah.
Because there is no click on a pill to fix. That's not a understand each other. And not that you mean we agree with everything on each other.
Right, right.
Just live life with it and know that when we disagree, we love each other enough that we can disagree.
Yeah.
And it won't be some kind of knocked down, dragged out, you know. Just live life. That way in itself, living life and understanding each other, we don't have to try to fix it. It's going to fix itself. But we don't live life. We isolate ourselves. That's the problem.
Mm.
Live life and be okay to step across the train tracks.
Right, right.
And on a regular basis.
Right.
And invite somebody to your big house that's got 4,000 square feet.
Right.
And just hang out. That's okay.
It's not nothing to be ashamed of.
Nope.
Either way.
Well, we're actually hilarious when we all disagree. Because sometimes we're all together. We don't all have the same perspective or opinions on it. Right. That's when it gets good.
Because we're all passionate about our opinions.
That's right.
But we love each other. And we'll disagree. And it's funny. But at the end of the day, we still love each other.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, exactly. And man, I tell you, like, people say, like, the value in church family. And I really never really felt like I knew a church family until I met you guys. And even then, it was like, am I going to fit in here kind of thing? Right. But, you know, now, like, me and Christy literally been on the other side of the planet together.
Yeah, we have.
You know, and when I first met you, I was like, I didn't see that coming, you know? And Keith, like, you, man, like, Keith has bought me and Kyla many a meal. You know what I mean? Like, and he didn't have to do that. But the truth is, like, we needed somebody to do that at the time, you know? And like, that's what I'm talking about, like, the realness of it. And even though now, like, technically I don't go to church with y'all no more, but it's amazing how whenever you run into somebody or you book an event, like the other day when we were all at the place for Daryl's birthday, it's just like, oh, bang, right on, switch just comes right back on.
That's family.
Yeah, you don't even think about it. I don't even know how many months, right? You know, because it can literally be a year, 6 months, a year. But the second it's like, oh, boom, let's get it. And it's, you don't even have to think about it. So I don't know. I'm just so thankful that the Lord had it in all of our lives for, because I really believe, like, our passions are really His passions that He just throws at us for whatever reason. Like, if he sees fit, you know, like my passion for music or whatever, well, that's really His passion, because ultimately He just wants me to glorify Him with this ability that He gave me. He can turn that off whenever He wants. He can take that ability away.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, I've seen it. I've seen great singers, and the voice goes away. And amazing how sometimes that'll glorify God more. Watching somebody sing through losing their voice, like Levon Hill was that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, great singer, but the Lord gave him throat cancer. But for the last, like, 10 or 12 years of his life, Levon kept singing. And you talking about passion and just, like, man, hearts being just grabbed. And that's what's made the things like that. So I don't mean to put a bow on it, but I got a couple more things that I want to run through, and just kind of, these are hot button topics. And, you know, like, the deal here is, I mean, it's not naturally, like, this is not naturally easy as far as, like, oh yeah, let's go there. Let's go on that hot topic.
Right.
Like, that'll really get me over. Some of this stuff, if somebody listens to this stuff, they're gonna probably email me or whatever. You know what I mean? But that's part of truth, I guess. You know. But I want to talk a little bit about the situation with Donald Trump. And, you know, Christy, I was actually with you when he got elected, and we kind of saw the whole thing go down and whatever, and we had a great conversation about that. And, you know, there was prayers and peace involved, and I'm thankful for that. But, you know, hey man, like, he's a white guy, I'm a white guy, I don't actually, to be honest with you, I don't fear Donald Trump, you know. And honestly, most of the stuff that he says, a lot of the stuff that he says I kind of like, you know, if I'm really being honest, you know. And I kind of like the vibe of, like, you know, the guy is different or whatever. Then again, there's other things that completely bother me, you know. And I don't know at what point is it healthy to support somebody on the percentage that you do like, but you still, it'd be like if somebody was agreed with me everything else except racism or something. I'm like, well, obviously we're never going to really connect, you know? So all the point is, beyond all that, I want to know specifically, like, and we're about to get into some of the feminism stuff too, before we roll out of here too, but I'd like to hear Keith, your perspective when the whole Donald Trump came on the scene. Is he really going to have a chance to actually get elected? Oh, snap, I think he's going to make it. Dang, he actually did get elected. Like, how did that whole thing go down in your head? What was your expectations?
My expectations, first of all, I'm a person that loves politics. I like politics. So I understand it better than most people, how it operates, what that kind of organism is. And most Americans don't understand it because they're driven by the media.
Right.
I understand what can really be done by a president, what can't be done. So what he really stands for. At first, I thought there's no way he can be elected. There was no way on earth. But then I saw, but you got to go back to his messages that he had, and it was specific. He played to one demographic, white males, because and when he knew what states, you know, they pretty much know what states because they have it so aligned, all the politics, they know what states they're going to get. But he knew what states he had to get to make it work. Rust Belt, white males, traditionally lost a lot of jobs. Most of them been Democrats all their life because it's unionized in those areas. So anytime you fear something that causes you to push back, he played against their fears. Hispanics is taking your, going to take your jobs. You're losing everything. You lose. Anytime somebody fear losing their identity, he played against them losing their identity. That's why they shifted. He played against their fears, and that's why he was elected. It worked. Just like black America has never had an identity as Americans. They've never getting that opportunity to identify. That's why it's hard. That's why we struggle, because we don't know what to identify. White males have always said, we're here. This is our country. We live here. This is our land. They've always identified it. They were sitting threat of that, losing that. So I knew he was going to win. At the last moment, I said he's going to win. And that's why. Now, I don't go back and say Donald Trump. You know, we know the things he's done, the things he's said. You don't always, you can't hold everything against a person. But that stuff hasn't stopped. He's the same person. It's a continuation. He's not presidential, whatever that means. He's not a good person. Forget all the presidential stuff out of the way. Donald Trump is not a good person. And for a Christian country who for 8 years took hammers against Obama on everything he did, one wife, two kids, two beautiful kids, where never said anything against anybody, literally was burned at the cross every day. We elected a man who said some horrendous stuff. How many wives? That's passed, but it's not stopped. And now we try to justify that and everything he does now, because what's happened, they know how bad he is, but now what happens is they can't say, or they can't run away from him, so they have to always support whatever he does. And he's still playing to the one crowd, the white crowd. Big rallies, majority white males. That's what he wants to hear. They pump him up, but they're still the ones that control stuff. So he has what he's going to play to. So it's like a propaganda machine. It's like we're living in another country, like Germany when Hitler. I'm not trying to say that. That's get you, you know, when you go there and there, Hitler and Trump. Not trying to do that.
No.
But the machine that's rolling with the fake news, calling every, when you label something fake news, that automatically for your people, whoever supports you, nullifies anything anybody else says now. So you go to one place to get your news, which is driven by you. That should never happen in any kind of government. That's dangerous. Because now the government is controlling the news. What makes us better than the Venezuela or anywhere, all these South American countries, you know, that tell the people what they're going to hear. So we're in a dangerous spot if Congress doesn't shift and start doing that job. Which they have the power to. President don't have a lot of power. He can talk crazy. So I'm not really worried about Donald Trump. He can't do anything. Just 4 years, he'd be gone. Congress is the one that can shape and shift things. They're the ones that's stuck in this Donald Trump bubble because they don't want to look like they're going against there because they're stuck in the party thing, the Republicans. So they have to kind of go along with him, but kind of. So the whole government is stuck right now because they don't know what to do. We're not progressing anywhere.
Christy, what are your thoughts on that situation?
You know, I'm a big picture person.
Right.
I think our last two presidents have been something this country had never seen. I mean, when President Obama was elected, obviously the first black president, and the response to that across the nation was something we had never seen. I'm not a master of U.S. history and politics, but I believe that probably the transition from President Obama's presidency to President Trump's presidency is one of the biggest polar shifts we've ever seen. Mm. And in 1 month, you know, whatever that day in January, inauguration day, I don't know that the pendulum philosophically, from an ideological perspective, methodology, philosophy of leadership, the way two men lead, from their cabinet positions to everything, I don't know that we've ever experienced a shift so deep and so wide. And I think that we're feeling that as a nation, whoever you're for or whoever you're against. Something that I've really been convicted about really over the last year is, Christy, what decisions are you making that are reactionary versus visionary? What is the vision for your life? What do you really think about something? What is your actual response to it versus just reacting to something? And Keith likes politics. I don't. I'm not even the best person to talk to about this. This isn't really in my wheelhouse or in my realm of really interest or specialty. But the news is hard for me, period, as somebody who takes teams to Israel multiple times a year. Because I watch the news and how it portrays Israel and the Middle East, and yet I have so many friends, so many connections there that I'm talking to on a weekly basis. And whatever I see in the news here, it is often not really what is going on over there. And so if we're doing that in issues of the Middle East, and maybe every news outlet at this point is less news and more perspective. Various networks are known for various things. But I know that I see that in their coverage of the Middle East. And so, of course, it makes me wonder how that bleeds into coverage of politics and things here. Mm-hmm. So, honestly, for me, it's kind of like, who do you even go to get your news? I like to read the Wall Street Journal, USA Today. Those are probably the two publications that I read. The Jerusalem Post, obviously, because I love Israel. But, you know, we talk about fake news. I don't know what true news is,
right,
really. Right. And so I think that just all the information that's going out, the energy that it would take to vet it, to figure out, is this sound? Is this actually based in something? Is this rhetoric? It's a lot. And our country is definitely feeling it. And like I said, I think our current president and our previous president, our country's never seen either.
Yeah.
And we're living in that.
Yeah, the topic of fake news is interesting because, I mean, I grew up in a pretty conservative Republican house, and I was always taught, you know, the major news media, they're all liberal, and they all want to push their agenda, you know. And so you've created a distrust between, it just happens to be the same demographic that Donald Trump people are. You know, which is why it affects me the way that it affects me and affects my dad the same way, you know, because he's been saying fake news for years. Maybe not in that particular way, but he just has always said, you know, all of it's, you know, is an agenda being pushed or whatever. So on one hand, I kind of think like, man, they kind of got this coming to them. This whole, they set themselves up for this because they weren't unbiased. Okay. But at the same time, like, man, like this guy is, I really believe Donald Trump is a master psychologist. At least in his own way, as far as effectiveness in what he's trying to get done, because he's out psychology and whoever he needs to do, you know, because like everything he does, I believe is on purpose. Like even his foolishness, like I don't think he cares. Like I think he goes on Twitter just to like ruffle feathers and just to stir the pot and stir the stink, because ultimately his demographic does the same thing. They do that. They go on Twitter and Facebook and they do their thing. You know, like that's his, as far as I know, I don't know every last one of them, but I've seen a lot of them do it that way. So it's interesting to me to see like the way that he's psychologically maneuvered the situation to discredit the news or whatever. So Keith, what are you thinking about all that?
Yeah. I disagree with you about Donald Trump. His action, I think he's just reactionary. He doesn't really know half the time what he's doing, because you would hope that it is something he's sitting there thinking, I'm going to mess with these people. One day I'm going to say I look for this and guess that. But what that does, as a man in power, it makes you look weak, not only to your people, but to the world. And what that does for government, it stalls it. And that's why he hasn't actually passed one policy since he's been in. He writes executive orders to change stuff, and that could be changed in 30 seconds with the next president. But no policy. We're still living under the same policies that Barack Obama was put out there, mm-hmm. Period. Nothing's changed. No economic policy, nothing. Now, if something goes great tomorrow, he'll claim it. But he hasn't done anything. So I think he's bad. I think he's a businessman. A rich businessman has been rich his whole life, silver spoon all his life, and it was always able to tell people what they're going to do. Government doesn't work that way. And as far as fake news, if all the media was as liberal as he said it is, how many Republican presidents have we had in the last 30 years? There wouldn't be none. That's not true. Yes, all of them to a degree is biased. All media is. That's just where that's what we got to. It's all in time. Go back to World War II when you go to the theaters and they would show on the screen. It was all patriotic. It was all biased. So all media has always been that way. But if it was so far one direction, if it was against one party or another, but it would dominate. You would never see the other party get anything. That's not true. Yes, we're all biased to a degree, but that's always been a tagline to certain people believe, and they live by it. But it works. You know, so that means you can discredit anything anybody say at any time. So how we get past that? The internet has allowed us to do a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
Research, look through it. You can find the basis of everything. I don't care how biased it is. If you read it, you're going to find the basis of it. People don't want to do the research. We can easily snap stuff all day long, but we're going to believe whatever somebody on TV said. Well, Donald Trump is the greatest president. He loved, instead of researching stuff. But we'll snap all day, Facebook all day long, but we don't want to research the truths. We don't want to get down to the bottom of it. We just take for whatever the first person said. Whatever news we're watching, we're good. So at some point, we have to be, the people has to do the research. We have the tools to do it.
Yeah, and that's what's different now is, like, we do have the tools to do it. And what's crazy to me, and, like, maybe I'm wrong on this, but, like, it seems sometimes like we have the tools, but we, like you said, we're not using it.
We're not using it.
Instead, we're reading the top line.
You go to whatever you want to, whatever outlet you want to hear it from that's going to tell you what you believe in. That's what you're going to do. We've aligned, we call everything fake news, but we align ourselves with news that's going to be only what we want to hear.
Mm-hmm.
So, is that all 100% good news? So, no, it's all biased to a degree.
So, oh man, part of the news deal, at first, you know, I want to try to keep the no drastic swerves or anything, but part of the news that I've seen, at least, and I'm not a news person, like I don't even have, you know, TV in there. I got the basic channels, right. And most of them are Hispanic Christian channels. With a lot of Selahs in Spanish and everything, which is fun in the middle of the day sometimes when you're cruising through there. And the Family Feud and the Drew Carey in the morning, and, you know, that's what I got. So, which is a whole nother topic because, man, if you look at the way they advertise to the people that have basic cable, good night, you want to feel stupid.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Mercy Lord. And everything's a drug.
Everything.
Or a lawyer, like a low-budget ambulance chasing lawyer, like making Saul Goodman look like,
right?
You know what I mean? Looking like the Kardashian lawyer. But anyway, but, and this is an area where I'm getting way off into the grass where I don't know nothing, but I sense, especially last year, a feminism movement of some sort. Now, I'm not saying it's brand new. I'm just saying that it's been on my radar more than it has in past years for the first time ever. So, some of the examples being, man, what was that, it was almost like it was something on Washington, wasn't it? They had a big event in Washington and all of that, right?
Well, it kind of revolved around Trump. It was a big women's march against Trump, is
right.
What it really was.
Some of the way he's treating women and some of the things he's talking about, grabbing this and all this stuff. Mercy. You know, yes. So it was specifically, we allowed this guy to be president, you know, and that was like their stand against. We're going to stand against this.
Okay, so Christy, I wish I had a better formal question to make this work, but basically I would like to know, like, and traveling around with Callie and Phoebe, we'd have these discussions from time to time, which is, you know, the first time I ever honestly, like, I was programmed thinking like every woman's feminist in some way or another. Why wouldn't they be? Like, I'm right. Manist, I guess.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like, I guess that's what I am. Like, right. I believe I'm a man, I do what I do, whatever.
Right.
But I guess my default programming told me that, well, sure, and they should be, because, I mean, yeah, women can do everything. Like, anything they want to do, in my opinion, you know, I'm programmed to believe that they can do it, because I've seen them do it, and I've seen them do a better job than men, you know, and specifically when men are absentee and you watch the women, like, they will step up, you know, and in the most legitimate way. And so, but then we get into the whole thing of, like, the Christian woman perspective of it all, and like, oh boy, now we got some scripture now that's and I don't know what to do with it half the time, because it seems like I know for sure right now there's a lot of there's certain parts of scripture that are under more scrutiny than others. Like, hey man, I love Jesus and this and that, and but this right here I don't agree with. I'm having more and more real conversations with people about like that than I have, and this is particularly one of them, and it's not one where I have like a really full opinion. So I'm asking. I'm coming from a place of asking, not telling. But I'd love to hear what you have to say on that as a woman that's in leadership and that has ability to teach the Bible in a very awesome way and preach the Bible and take and been a leader in my life, a spiritual leader in my life. Like, I take off on it.
Well, I said earlier that symbols matter. They're communicative. Terms matter, too. So when you say feminism, I don't necessarily know what you mean by that or whatever a technical definition of that is. Neither do you. I'm going to probably be a little boring in my response to this. You know, I think that the Bible is clear that every single human being is made in the imago Dei, in the image of God. And so what we're seeing in culture, if what you mean, the feminist movement, are women finding their voice and rising up and contending for equal pay, for equal work and things like that, I think that's a matter of justice. And I think that it's a worthy task that both men and women are working together in. I think that one misnomer is that only women are feminist. I know a lot of men who are feminist, who are very pro-woman, and they really seek to use their positions of male, particularly white male, privilege and power to set tables and to invite women to those tables in meaningful and diverse ways. When you go all the way back to Genesis, I think God's original design, I think God loves diversity. And we've been talking a lot about racial diversity and cultural diversity, but I believe God loves gender diversity, too. You know, it's interesting. God was with Adam in the Garden of Eden, and God still said it wasn't good for Adam to be alone. I think that's a striking thing because we always, as Christians, go around saying, well, all you need is Jesus. All you need is God. Mm. And if we mean for salvation, then yes, salvation is found in no other name. But there's a vertical component to us, but there's also a horizontal. Right. And I really think that it's as we walk with God and with one another, there was some kind of a mutually symbiotic flourishing and shalom that happened when God created Eve and brought her to Adam. We think of Adam and Eve almost always in terms of a marital union. They were married, had children, but really it's just the diversity of thought and opinion. I mean, whatever you mean by I'm a manism, I've got manism, feminism. Man, you put men and women together working on any task, any problem, and there's a richness there because men feel things in their maleness and women feel things in their femaleness. And when you bring those two together, it's a really powerful thing. Something that I do often say, both when I'm teaching at the college, when I'm speaking in churches, or when I'm talking to people, because I am a woman in leadership in the community, with what I do in teaching the Bible, is no man needs to be any less for me to be fully me.
Amen.
Nobody needs to be diminished for another to be exalted. If that's what you mean by feminism, I'm against it. Mm-hmm. But the kingdom of God is big enough for all of us to be fully alive, fully awake, fully holding our space in our stories, using our gifts and abilities within our communities and unto the ends of the earth, as Jesus would say it. So when I find people who really live in a Philippians 2 mindset, when Philippians 2 talks about how Jesus, though being equal with God, emptied himself and made him a servant, outside of feminism or anything else, when you show me men who are willing to come to a meaningful table and divest, empty themselves and become servants, you show me women who are willing to come to that same table and live in a Philippians 2 way, empty themselves and become a servant. Jesus said it. It's when you lose your life that you gain it. Mm-hmm. And so I tend to be a little bit hesitant about agendas or philosophies of thought that are all about sort of acquisition for self or the exaltation of a certain gender or anything like that, because I think it's lacking just the holistic truth that God gives us, and that is God's heart for man and woman, as individuals and together, whether it's through marriage, whether it's through friendship, whether it's coworkers and colleagues, whether it's church family living in our communities, is that we would all seek to be agents of justice and righteousness, to generously lift one another up, to edify one another. So if we end up in a situation where you as a white male have power and privilege that I don't have as a white female, or that Keith doesn't have as an African-American male, what does it look like for you to steward your power in that moment?
Right.
And to seek to lift up other? When Keith is in a moment, man, Keith's an amazing cook, but let me tell you something. Keith is running all of the technology in the entire world. Seriously, he is the guy behind the curtain. And he is so gifted in so many ways that most of us in our community are not. And I see Keith stewarding that. He understands that he's got very strong skill sets and a knowledge base in areas that a lot of us don't, and that oftentimes we need him. And he is so willing to divest, to like serve his community out of his strengths and out of his wellspring. And I just think the more we live like that, the more, if we were to live like that, think about how you wouldn't need a feminist movement.
Right, right.
Because we all are coming to the table together and seeking to make room for one another in meaningful ways.
Amen.
So that was probably very boring.
No, I don't know.
Feminism is not a lightning rod topic for me, but I believe that that's God's heart, man. The kingdom of God is huge. It's vibrant. It's creative. It's flourishing. It's growing. God is restoring all things. He's renewing all things. He's resurrecting all things. He's redeeming all things. So how do we become a part of that?
Right. Amen. Well, I tell you, man, I don't really know how to follow all this up. I mean, I almost think it's time to hit the go home button here. Mm-hmm. Unless there's anything else that we feel like we want to talk about here at the end. Anybody else got anything else? Yeah. I'm pretty happy with the way this turned out. We spent some extra time, and it was rich for me to listen throughout the whole thing. And thank y'all both for coming and for going to some uncomfortable areas here and allowing me to ask you some awkward questions. Believe me, it was awkward for me too. So, I won't, you know, but at the same time, you know, I think it can be good if people will listen, but also if they'll just take and do it themselves and do it better than us, you know, like do it, like there's way more qualified and powerful, like you said, like stewards of power than us out there, you know. And I'm just thankful that, like you said, the Lord put us in community together specifically, which is crazy because we all come from different, like, whatever angles, different places. But you both have been a big time blessing in our lives, and continues to be that way. So thank you. That's kind of my big thing. Ian, do you have any finishing up thoughts there? Man, it's good to be back on the old podcast world.
Yes.
If you like what you've heard today, feel free to subscribe. I'm not going to say I put out an episode every week, but I put them out whenever I get the inspiration, and I feel like it's worthy of your time. So if you want to subscribe and be on all that, it's free. Go to iTunes, look up my thing, Nashville Talks with Taylor Jones, easy to find. And if you feel like this was a worthy couple hours, man, like, spread it around. Maybe we can get some conversation started. That's kind of the whole deal. Is just
people talking.
Just strike that. It starts somewhere.
People living together.
Living together. That's what I would say. Is the people not only just go to other. I don't care if it's women, whatever. Sit in those communities and be okay to be uncomfortable, and to just listen. Don't try to control it. Just be a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the biggest takeaway from this whole. Yeah. It's actually the unified theme of this entire podcast. Yeah. Yeah.
Just exist in it, you know. So, well, if that's it, then that's it, man. We, I'm like I said, this has been awesome. So, thank you guys for listening, and again, thank you three for being here with me and doing this and
thanks
coming all this
us.
Way. Chester hanging out down here, keeping the stress level down. You know, he's the resident therapy dog for us right now. So, but until next time, for Ian Stewart, Keith Grigsby, and Christy McClellan, I'll see y'all later.